Right now, it is time for the Frick and Frack of Nick and Nack. Tim Luke and Greg Strom, the appraisal guys. Of course, you can find them at tqag.com or right here on a Tuesday morning on Robinhood Radio, or flying all over the world with their million-dollar points bonus. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning, Marshall. How are you?
I'm fine. And the person who owned the Mickey Mantle baseball card shattered all auction records. The Holy Grail of baseball cards, the 1952 Mickey Mantle card, $12.6 million.
Yes. Pretty amazing, isn't it?
It beat the previous high card by more than $5 million.
I don't know if you saw any of the other items as well, but just in general, that entire sale was phenomenal. I mean, that's some of the highest prices I think we've ever seen for sports collectibles and cards in particular.
That particular card had such a history because of its condition. I mean, being in such mint condition is what really drove, I think, a lot of the bidders to really bid on that piece.
Right, go on, Greg.
There was a second one that was also in the sale, and even that sold for $705,000. It wasn't in this exact same condition, but it was in excellent condition. It was graded, but even that $705,000. I mean, two rookie cards, and you see what the difference in price is. Primarily because of the provenance and also the condition.
Now, had we led with that $700,000 card, that would have been amazing. But now, after $12.5 million, it's like, that's minor leagues. $700,000, minor leagues.
Yeah, I carry that much around in my pocket, so don't you?
You know, perception is reality. Perception is reality, though. I mean, if you go out to buy a car, and the first car you see would say is the top of the line Rolls Royce, okay, and then the next car you go out to see is, let's say, the most expensive Cadillac. Well, you know, the difference is so unbelievable that it's shocking. The second one looks like just an average thing, and that's the amazing thing when a car breaks a record by $5 million. That's just astounding.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, and it also has eclipsed the Honus Wagner baseball card, because if you remember last year, that Honus Wagner sold for $7.7 million. So it's right up there. And Honus Wagner has continued to be the most expensive baseball card for years. It's held that distinction. And now with this Mickey Mantle piece, it really has changed the playing field, let's say.
Yeah, well, I also noticed that there were several other Mantle cards. There were actually, I think, three rookie cards. The third one was, it sold for $138,000. But there were some other ones that, I mean, they were selling for like $300,000. So, I mean,
Mickey Mantle, totally, but also, Greg, the distinction is there are different designs to that card as well.
Yep.
So that is also what drives the collectability. Is it Mickey Mantle? I think one of them, it's standing in front of like a telephone pole, and then it's another one that's more of a close-up. So I believe me, you don't forget these things when you know how much they go for.
Well, when you look at it at first glance, it's an amazing price, and like I said, when you compare it to what went before it, you just kind of blink and you say, "Really?" But here's another one. Then this one I love. How many people out there in the world own or have driven a Ford Escort? Millions, 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 millions. All right. Well, the Ford Escort, which was driven by Princess Diana for 3 years, sold for $764,000 at an auction.
What?
$764,000
Wow.
Quoting the auction house, "We've sold a number of motor cars that have royal pedigree, but this car tricks every box in terms of history, rarity, condition, and mileage. It's one of the early RS models that Ford did. So it's not your typical Escort, but still, the car brand new, I think even that car, was only about $35,000. And about 25 years after she passes away, it sells for, well, in pounds, £650,000, but in dollars, $764,000 a Ford Escort.
That's amazing. It's amazing what a little provenance can do. Huh? I mean, to have that royal pedigree and all of that, that makes a difference, but also so many years after her life. And that would have been while she was, that was before she met Charles, or right when she met Charles, right? It was as they were dating, and the press were probably chasing her around while she was driving that.
It's just
you can actually see the car in film clips. I mean, if you've watched any of the documentaries on the Royals or on Diana, but I think Diana, the fact when you say royal pedigree, it's not just the royal pedigree, because there have been royal cars that have belonged to certain other royals that have come up. Nothing. This is the for lack of a better word, the royalist pedigree you could get. I mean, she's achieved mythical status as someone who is a royal, and that in and of itself is one of the reasons I think that it did command so much money, It will. Who knows when it comes up for sale again? But I mean, that's
Princess Diana and her fame will never go away.
No,
there's certain famous people that are very famous, but then there's the other. There's the legendary status of their personalities and their memory. And she's in there with people like Muhammad Ali, Gandhi. I mean, there's certain people that are just there.
But you know, the other thing about it, and we've talked about this before, is that there's also so much fascination. The public has such fascination for it that there are so many video clips, there are so many video documentaries, there are so many things that you can go to YouTube and you can Google and you can find so much information, and they continue to put that out there, and that's what builds a legacy. I mean, and we've talked about that. It's the Beatles. You have a whole like new generation learning about the Beatles because of Spotify, and they have easy access to it, and when you have that makes it much I guess bigger for that and better for the legacy, because everybody then it permeates the entire culture.
Well, we'll go from those two to this one, and this is a if you love Elon Musk and if you love potential bidding on something that you might be able to afford, PSA 10 Elon Musk signed U.S. dollar bill, $1 bill, is up for auction. It's owned by his ex-girlfriend, Jennifer Gwynn. It's a $1 bill that he has autographed, okay? And it's going up for auction. It's currently at a bid. The bid price for it is $2,662. They think that it will get to $5,000. There's 25 more days to go before the auction.
Wow.
Now, on top of that dollar, she's selling a number of photographs, a signed birthday card, and also a 14-karat gold necklace that was gifted to her by Musk. I tend to think it'll go for a little more than $5,000.
Well, there again, I guess it depends on how many people are... I mean, how many people are... what do you call it? Muskies? he's done some kind of
wacky
Yeah, wacky things that have kind of hurt his brand a little bit. But, I mean, he still is, like, the wealthiest man, I guess the wealthiest man in the world. And, I mean, he certainly has impacted what's happening in the automobile world and also in space age stuff. So, there are a number of different ways you could look at this as a collectible. Did it, you know, just because it's initialed by Elon Musk, the fact that he's done all of these other things, if that's why, you know, if you want to be a part of Elon Musk, this would be it. And even if it sells for $10,000, I still think it would be a bargain.
I mean, technically it's only worth
a dollar, so...
Right. But the provenance itself has, I mean, it's got great provenance, so that's wonderful. And I think that, yes, I would agree with what Greg is saying. I think this first sale, it'll sell where it is, but I think as time goes on, and these are types of things, you know, we're dealing with this modern day, whether you like it or like it or not, this genius that has really changed the way that we are looking at electric vehicles, all sorts of vehicles, space exploration and transportation, and who knows where things will go. So that will also impact the future value of that particular collectible, because it may, you know, maybe okay now, but like his whole thing to buy Twitter and how things go on. It's amazing how these things impact the value. It's these intangibles and these actions that impact the tangible assets that are collectible. And you have to take those things into consideration.
Or just take this. Let's say somebody buys it. Let's say they pay $10,000 for it. Okay, let's say 25 years from now or 30 years from now, if he succeeds in his quest to go to Mars,
right?
What is that going to be worth for the generations that now own that dollar bill?
Exactly. And let me just put it in perspective, is that the little pieces of cloth from the Wright brothers' plane, they have gone to space because they have put those into the astronauts have taken those up into space. Those little pieces of cloth, they're 1 by 1 inches of cloth that are selling for $200,000 to $300,000.
Oh, we lost you there, Tim.
I think we lost him.
Tim, $1,000.
So it does have potential.
You're breaking up on us, Tim.
I know exactly where he is. If he's breaking up, he's on Bridge Road on his way to I-95, and he's going through a dead zone. I know it.
Well, we'll wait to see if he comes back.
But you know, the thing is, it would be, I would, you know, why doesn't he sign, or they don't have them anymore, but I'd like to have a $100,000 bill signed by Elon Musk. That would have a little more gravitas, but they don't make, I guess they don't, I think the largest they make now is 100, but they used to make 100,000 used to be the largest. But yeah, that, you know, that's going to be around for a long time. Just this first thing here is a signed dollar bill. I think it's going to end up, I think you're right, Marshall. I would expect it to go for more than that. I mean, it would be a fun thing to have. I mean, it would be an interesting way to start a collection.
It would be a long-term investment that you're looking for your family, actually, is what it is.
Yeah, exactly.
Tim, are you back with us?
I think so. Am I there? Hello?
You're here
sort
now.
Of, yeah.
Maybe not.
You're here.
Yeah, you're here.
Can you hear us, Tim?
I'm on my way to Mars. I'm on my way to Mars, yes.
Okay. Now, this, Tim, this is directly for you to answer, okay?
Okay.
In New York, the Attorney General has now ramped up the investigation into Sotheby's. They're accusing Sotheby's of helping more clients evade taxes.
Huh. That's, yeah. Well, that's interesting. How did they Do they say in the story? I've got to read up on this one because I'm not familiar with this. How did they catch Sotheby's?
Well, they're more. It's I think it's more of locking horns where they've requested documents and they don't really say why it was filed. But this lawsuit was filed in 2020. They had the case dismissed. Huh. Sotheby's tried to have the case dismissed, but they were not able to. The Attorney General asked Sotheby's for a list of 51 clients the state understands to be characterized right. as level one clients and to produce any New York resale certificates on the file, identify clients from that time.
Got it. So this is, and this goes to, even when Greg and I were doing auctions here in Florida and we would sell to dealers, we always insisted on getting copies of the resale certificates. This is a major thing because this dates back even to the 90s, the 80s and 90s. Both Christie's and Sotheby's were held in, they were asked for their clients' resale numbers because of this tax issue, because they would just say, oh yeah, oh, you have a resale number? Okay, great, we won't charge the tax. And they were really cheating the state out of a lot of income because of that, and this is probably another area that they were watching, especially with their VIP clients, of saying, oh, okay, we'll just put in something where they had a resale number but actually did not.
Yeah, you're right, and the case centers around, it began around one person, a collector by the name of Isaac Sultan, president of the Atlantic Feeder Services in the United States in Miami. He's known for collecting Latin American and contemporary art. That's the case the red flag went up on, that they figured, well, if there's one, there might be others.
You think?
Well, you think that Sotheby's would have learned a lesson by now. Of course, everybody's innocent until proven guilty, but come on.
Right, but Greg, you have to remember that there are people that are there and that work there for a while, and then there's a lot of staff changes. There's a lot of there's changes at the top. There's changes throughout the business, changes in attitudes, yeah. And you know, and all of that makes a big difference. And that's what you have to look at, is that it's, you know, it was a time period when they were, okay, we've got to watch this and really be careful. And they might have just, they became lax because it became a way for their client to say, we'll bid more, but we don't want to pay taxes. And I don't know. I'm just speculating.
One final thing for you guys to chew on, and I think this is something that's good. New York museums are now required to acknowledge art that was stolen under Nazis. It's part of a package of legislation the governor signed to boost education about the Holocaust and honor survivors. So New York museums have to acknowledge the art was stolen under the regime of the Nazis.
I think it's a very good thing.
I think it is too, but I believe it will probably open up yet another Pandora's box within the Pandora's box, and that is if it's identified as something that was stolen by the Nazis, and it's in the museum, it had to have belonged to someone prior, before
yeah.
it was stolen. So will these people be able to file a reparations claim or anything? That's one of the things I'd like to know about.
And the whole thing is, they estimate there's more than 600,000 documents that will be subject to this. Works that were created before 1945 that changed ownership in Nazi Europe and registered into the Art Loss Register. That database actually has more than 700,000 works of lost, stolen, or looted art.
I'm one of those people who still believe that there are thousands and thousands and thousands of pieces of art that haven't been discovered. Not that someone has them, but during the war, when they hid a lot of these things in mines and such, I'm one of those. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I do believe that there are still unknown and undiscovered pieces of art that were stolen by the Nazis and stored somewhere. That's what I'm thinking. So I hope this is just the tip of the iceberg. I think it's wonderful.
Does this open up companies, auction companies, that sooner or later they're going to be demanded to give proof that didn't come from Nazi stealing?
I would think so. I would think so.
I want to put out there that I do.
Oh, I think we lost him again.
Yep, he's definitely on the Mars rover.
Hello?
Yes, now you're back again. You guys, repeat what you just said that we didn't hear.
Yeah, I do know that at Heidman and a lot of other auction companies that they do check all of the pieces that are going up to make sure that it's not on the stolen register, because it could be from the Nazis, or it could be if the piece was stolen from a museum. So I do know that there's a lot of due diligence that a lot of the auction companies do to make sure that the pieces that they are selling are not on that loss register. So that is happening. But I do think that if it's in a museum and it's been there and they're tagging it as stolen, it does help with the education of, hey, this was something that happened in society, and you need to be aware of it. I do think that that's good.
All right. So now where are you heading to now, Tim?
We are headed to first to Tampa, Florida, then to Naples, Florida, and then we'll be driving back on Thursday afternoon. So I'm with my assistant, hi. Margaret. Say hi, Margaret. Yeah, Margaret's in the car. So,
all right.
She's been enjoying the show quietly.
Well, you have a safe automobile trip there, Tim, and we'll speak to you next week.
Definitely.
Have a great week.
Have a wonderful weekend.
And Greg, you have a calming, relaxing week, keeping the ranch in fine stead.
Yeah. I will. Have a great week, Marshall.
Take care,
buddy.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Tim, Luke, and Greg Schramm, the appraisal guys, the frickin' frack of Nick and Knack with Appraise. This here at Robinhood Radio. Of course, you can find them at tqag.com on the web. And here at robinhoodradio.com, click on demand, click on the different shows that you follow. And by following on demand, if you like a show and you like to get the show, you can also sign up and have that show automatically delivered to you whenever it's updated by Robinhood Radio, which means you'll wake up one morning and the computer will be, boom, the new shows will be there. You don't even have to look for them. They'll just be there on your computer. All right? That's robinhoodradio.com on demand. And for, of course, Appraise This, you then click on Appraise This.